Some say Christopher Thomas was abused by the justice system. Thomas was 14 years old when he was convicted to 40 years in prison for his involvement in a non-lethal shooting.
Chris Thomas and Chris Butts were involved in an armed robbery at a pawn shop. The two other young men involved were older. The owner of the pawn shop was shot in the shoulder. Chris Thomas and Chris Butts were apprehended by police.
A group of students at Kennesaw State University reported on that story. They used virtual reality, among other things, to tell about Christopher Thomas's experience in Georgia's criminal justice system. Here to talk about this project is Leonard Witt. He's the executive director of the Center for Sustainable Journalism at Kennesaw State University. Good morning.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And also with us is one of Leonard's journalism students, Anne Ondieki. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
It's good to have you as well.
Thank you very much.
This conversation is another installment of our occasional series, Lessons from Left Field. That's where we highlight unique courses that are taught here in Georgia. So, Leonard, let's examine what makes this course unique. In what way do you use virtual reality for journalism?
Okay, so this was underwritten by the Online News Association. We got a nice grant for a challenge grant in journalism education. And what we wanted to do is figure out how we could get youth voices heard and their stories told and save their anonymity. So we came up with the idea of let's use virtual worlds and avatars to tell the story. Now, when Christopher Thomas came in, things changed a little bit, but that was a central idea. And the ONA liked it so much that they gave us this grant.
Okay, so then, Anne, you were doing journalism for years before you ever took this class, correct?
Yes, I did.
So how was this process different? What changed when you added the virtual reality into it?
It gave me a new understanding of what the virtual reality was. So it broadened my perspective as a student that, like Leonard said, to be able to protect the identity of minors, we are able now to present their stories in a different way.
Because it looks like The Sims a little bit. It's just a created character.
It does, but it's very similar almost, actually. You use all the same techniques if you were out on the field running around live and, you know, using a camera like you would use on GPB TV, except you're doing it all in virtual world. So the students who do this, they have to create, first of all, the avatars. Then they worked with Gwinnett Ryder Sinclair, and we got to mention her because she's the expert in this. And then she showed them how to build sets. So for one of the things we did, they built a whole set of 5th and Ab Street in Chicago, and it looks exactly like the street. And sometimes when you look at the real street that we built from Google Earth, you can't tell the difference between the avatar virtual world street. And the characters run. We have different angles. They talk. We, you know, do voiceovers. So it's really kind of amazing. And our work right now, frankly, is still a little primitive because we're just starting it. But the possibilities of this are going to be remarkable because even when you watch an avatar, you still get the sense that it's a real thing, even though it's a cartoon character. That kind of disappears in your mind, and your mind plays a little trick on you.
And how does it change the journalism itself? Did you find you had a different understanding of the story after having to, as Leonard was explaining, recreate sets and try to create it in a 3D world?
Yeah, besides just writing now, we went into just the basics of learning how to create the avatars. So it makes you like, it immerses you into the story, basically. Like you get in there and you're able to visualize, okay, this is the story that I have, and then you recreate it in the virtual world. So it was kind of very interesting trying to not only learn how to write the story, but now how to produce the avatars and just... tell the story in a different way.
So, Leonard, let's actually get into the basics of Christopher's story. It is a long one in which we can't retell the whole thing during this interview. But Christopher Thomas had been a foster kid. And I think in a certain way, this reporting that your students did is really about the school-to-prison pipeline, is it not?
It's that, and it's a lot more. It's really about the failing of a society. Here's a kid. He's abandoned at age 2. His mom's strung out on crack and in jail. He goes to his grandparents' house, but along with his other 4 or 5 siblings. and they can't take care of him. So he gets passed around to different foster care. Every time he goes into a foster care house, he acts very poorly. Because in his mind, if I act really bad, they're going to send me back to my grandparents, who I really love.
Back to his grandparents, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And so that's his life pattern. He's always getting in trouble in school. He gets passed around. I guess if you're around him, he's not a pleasant kid at that time. But he's still a kid. 12 years old, this is where the pipeline goes. He curses in a class. They send in the past, it would have been a principal worked with the kid, and maybe they get, if the right world, they get him a social work and everything else. But now you're in a school and you have a special resource officer, which is a cop. The cop goes looking for him after he storms out of a class, passes him in the hall and says, "What's your name?" And he gives his brother's name. Rather than saying Christopher, he says, he's 12. He says, "I'm Jarvis Thomas." That is a felony, and he gets charged with a felony for telling the cop, giving false reporting
to police.
So then the cop finally tracks him down and gets in an argument with Christopher. And rather than trying to defuse it, he gets Christopher in a chicken wing hold, which really hurts Christopher a lot. 12 years old, man. He starts cursing, and he swears he's going to kill the cop. Terroristic threats,
felony,
and disrupting school. So he has these three, felonies. They send him off to a boot camp, which is the worst possible place.
This is under Zell Miller, which people may remember was an effort to do these kind of almost scared straight sort of programs.
Correct, which don't work. And although Zell said, don't tell me they won't work. I don't need a pointy head telling me they won't work.
Yeah, he rejected the statistics.
You give any kid a kick in the pants, they're going to be fine. So he rejected the statistics. And in, Christopher's case, it didn't work. So now Christopher has this record. They don't know what to do with him. They try and put him in hospitals. And finally, they send him to this woman's house, in another county. And what does she do every morning with these troubled kids who she's supposed to be taking care of? She locks him out of the house at 8 o'clock in the morning and doesn't let him back in until 5. So they fall in with this character called Rambo. He's in his 20s. Somehow collusion. Let's go rob a pawn shop. Christopher's unarmed. He's an unarmed tag along. But one of the other kids, he's 15, and the older guy isn't there anymore. He walks in and they shoot the pawn shop owner. Now,
they don't kill him, they shoot him in the shoulder.
Shoot him in the shoulder, non lethal, but they shoot him, And so they haven't been able to figure out what to do with Christopher for all of these years. The state hasn't figured out. Well, now they figure out exactly what to do with Christopher, and the judge figures, we're going to put you in a cage for the next 40 years.
Partly as a result, Anne, it appears that the judge used the earlier very serious crimes he was charged with at age 12 as justification for the 40-year sentence. Mm-hmm. Through your reporting on this, what do you feel like you discovered about the criminal justice system and how it handles minors?
Basically, I thought my own thinking is that it wasn't the right way, but it was basically based on his history, according to what evidence was presented to him. Christopher was judged based on unfortunate incidences of the past. So basically, I don't think, in my own view, I don't think it was the right way, but the judge just passed the judgment, which I think was not right for Christopher.
Yeah.
Why was this, Leonard, the right story for what you were trying to teach these students?
Well, we were looking for actually a simpler story, and we ran into Steve Reba from, bless his heart, from the Barton Law Center at Emory, and he dropped on the students thousands of pages of records. And when we started to read them, we were like, how can you justify putting a 14-year-old who's been kicked around his whole life and putting him in a cage? And I use that term because that's where he is for 40 years. He's been in there for 17 years. If this had happened, this is like our own gulag. We take kids of color that we don't know what we're going to do with, and we shove them into prisons. Usually, nobody sees them. Nobody knows a word about them. They're hidden there, and they want them hidden away. Fortunately, we came across this, and our students, and they really were the hardest working students I've ever been around, 11 students, all of these pages of stuff, they put together this story, and they are going to expose, or at least let people know, that there is a human being who's been put in a cage and totally forgotten about from age 14, and if he stayed in there until he was 55 years old. this is an injustice, and I want my students, as reporters, to look at these kind of things and expose these injustices. Am I passionate about this? Guess what? Yes.
Apparently so. But, and let's take it back in the minute that we have left. Let's take it back to the virtual reality. Let's say that you're working on a story in the future and you don't have virtual reality technology with you. Has this experience changed the way you might approach future stories?
Oh, yeah. Basically, if I encounter a story that I cannot tell, like, I don't have the pictures. I know now I can go tap into the knowledge that I gained through this class and be able to create a more compelling story through the virtual world. So it has exposed me a lot. The information that we were able to gather and the instructions given by Gwyneth Writer Sinclair, as Leonard mentioned, have given me a new perspective of telling some very compelling stories.
So you just heard from Anne Ondieki. She is a Kennesaw journalism student, and Leonard Witt is the executive director of the Center for Sustainable Journalism at Kennesaw State University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Well, thank you for having us. And we really hope that people pay attention, jjie.org or on GPB's site right here,
to read about
Christopher.
You can find the story at our website, gpbnews.org, and you can also see how they told this story with virtual reality. We're pretty used to hearing that indie artists are hard to categorize, right? But in the case of Kishibashi, it's really true. His first solo album creates thick soundscapes with violin and vocal loops. It's complicated yet delicate, and his voice transitions from low pitches up to falsetto. It's hard to describe. Kishibashi is a pseudonym for Kaoru Ishibashi. Tonight he'll perform at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta, not too far from Athens, where he is now based. And he joins me now to talk about his new album, Sonderlust. Kishibashi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're actually on a tour bus, are you not? Traveling from Athens to Atlanta?
Yes, we're in a truck stop somewhere in Alabama, I believe.
Well, I appreciate your pulling over.
Sure.
At what point did you know the music thing was going to work, that you didn't need a backup plan?
Well, that's a pretty big question. I'm 40 now, but when I was 36, I moved out of New York City to kind of give it a last-ditch effort, you know, as far as making music for a living, and that was my debut album. So, I guess a few years ago,
it was a last-ditch effort that really paid off.
I think so, but you know, who knows? It couldn't. I'm sure there are alternate life paths that could have happened.
We have some clips of your music to play, and so I kind of want to do them in chronological order. So let's go back to 2011. This is the song Manchester.
Page. I didn't even look. I think I locked it in a cage. Wrote a novel.
You know, I feel like a lot of people describe some of your music, especially some of this early stuff, as soundscapes, which I reject personally because it's a song and then backings. But I wonder what you start with. Do you start with the mood or the sound, or do you start with the actual just the song?
I'm a musician first, instrumentalist, so it's all music. So I kind of create, you know, I guess I do create soundscapes. I create sound and then I force a song into it. Usually is how it works.
So, and then do the lyrics, are they the last thing?
They're always the last. So words for me, like the words float out as kind of like instruments, you know, themselves. And then as strong words form for like the choruses, that's where I turn them into stories.
So I want to hear how your music transforms when you're actually playing mostly acoustically, and in this case live. This is from what became a very popular Tiny Desk concert for NPR from 2012. This is I Am the Antichrist to You. How do you choose your playlists for each venue? How do you change it up?
You mean like a set list?
I think.
Honestly, I keep the same set list for the entire tour a lot of times because I like to think of it as a play. You know, when you're like, when you take a Broadway show on the road, it's like they don't change up the story. You know, so I kind of evolve it and perfect it, and you know, and have like moments. A lot of times there'll be little differences, but for the most part, I like to keep the same set list.
But that implies that you choose a set list based and you think it's telling a story, right?
Yeah, there's an arc to it. You know, there's a lot of like it'll start with like maybe new songs, or it'll start with things, or I'll have things to talk about, and then I'll have like a little theater. You know, there's a couple theatrical elements in it too. You know, so but I feel like I don't feel bad about repeating the same set list because there is an arc.
Right. So let's then move forward to the new album, and this is one of the bigger tracks off of it. This is "Hey Big Star" from the new album Sunderlust. So this one was produced by Chris Taylor of Grizzly Bear. How did his production change your sound, do you think?
I think the reason why I approached him was that he has great taste, and I needed somebody to kind of ground me in a more simple production. So I needed somebody to basically tell me that you don't need all these crazy elements that you might have added in the past.
It sounds like you felt like you needed an editor.
Yeah, that's what a producer is a lot of times.
And there's this sound. I mean, there's an element of risk to the sound in this music. Like, it's almost as though each track is just this side of spinning out of control.
Thanks.
That's a good thing, to my mind. But you called it the musical equivalent of Fumes. And I wonder what you mean by that.
Oh, Fumes. Okay. When I was creating the earlier, like my past two albums have been violin centric, meaning that I would compose them from the violin. But this time around, it was when I was writing new songs, it became the musical equivalent of Fumes, meaning like that there were. Really, it wasn't inspiring to me, so I took a totally different approach, and I composed a lot electronically and through the keyboards.
Okay, so you say it wasn't inspiring to you, and I assume you're referring to, you've just said that you were sort of at an impasse before this album, and the way you describe it sounds like you were like the musician's version of writer's block?
So what was happening was that because my first two albums were pretty well received, and you know, a lot of people were kind of, I assumed that a lot of my listeners were expecting a similar sound. So as I approached the compositional process and the songwriting process, I just found that I couldn't come up with anything that was interesting to myself, which is like the worst way, worst position to be in. So, because that would translate into the album. So I took a totally new approach.
And what was that breakthrough moment for you?
I think there was the kind of catharsis when I understood that the music, that this album would just be a snapshot of, you know, of my life, and it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be a continuation of my previous work. It's basically an album for an artist is just that moment in time.
And this moment in time seems to have come from a place, you called it a place of heartbreak, which it sounds like your success. Maybe, I don't want to assume anything, but maybe you weren't quite prepared for the rigors of touring or how exhausting musical success could be. Is that fair?
I mean, touring is definitely, it's a lot of it has to do with my family and just touring and my marriage, essentially. It's a difficult thing for me to even talk about, but it is like, it's definitely in there, like as far as like the lyrically, I really found an avenue to pour out my emotions into the lyrics.
And that's just kind of the line where I want to take a moment to explore, because you say it's difficult for you to talk about, and yet you're such a romantic musically, and you basically just wear your heart on your sleeve. And if you're touring, that means you're pouring these lyrics out night after night after night, city after city after city. What's the difference between that and talking about it?
Well, because, you know, I'm a musician and not an orator, you know, so it's difficult for me to talk about like it with words. But as far as emotion, when I'm on stage, it's like I make my music for my listeners. So I open myself up as much as possible.
And that's not as difficult. That's less painful. Is it actually therapeutic?
It's definitely therapeutic. There's a lot of emotions because every time I sing certain songs, I do feel there's a lot of pain involved. But, you know, it's like it's with any art, the more personal it is, the better it is.
I think you told our producers that your last concert was kind of low energy and you're wondering if people were worn out from Halloween. Is that right?
Yeah, we just had a show in New Orleans last night and you're like, every time we go to New Orleans, you know, you think everybody just wants to party all the time.
Screaming,
but, you know, but we played a show the day after Halloween. And it was definitely subdued, surprisingly.
Yeah, and your energy is so, well, for me anyway, it's hard to listen to without smiling. It's very joyful. And how does that change your performance, do you think? How does the audience's behavior or their attitude change the way you play?
If the energy is not high, then it might affect us psychologically. I'm sure musically we're all like trained musicians, you know. So I feel like it probably doesn't affect the actual show. Some of the banter might change, you know,
right.
Between songs.
Yeah. It's become more morose. Let's hear another clip from the new album. This is Say Yeah. We got about 30 seconds left. Do you feel like the writer's block has gone? Has that demon been banished?
I don't know. I kind of approach it as like a case by case basis. So you can probably ask me before I start writing for the next album.
It may be a different answer. Sonnolust is the latest project by now Athens musician Kishibashi. He'll take the stage at Atlanta's Variety Playhouse tonight at 8. And Kishi, I hope the audience has a little more energy for you.
I'm sure they will. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good one. During World War I, on Christmas Day, French, British, and German soldiers laid down their arms and climbed up out of the trenches to exchange holiday greetings. It's known as the Christmas Truce. And Emory University professor Patrick Allitt has joined me before to talk about it. Here he is with an explanation of what happened in the lead-up to the Christmas Truce.
When the war began, the idea was that it was all going to be over incredibly quickly. Warfare had become so highly industrialized in the preceding 100 years that all the great nations were afraid that whoever mobilized first would win very quickly. That obviously proved to be a massive miscalculation because defensive weapons were so much more powerful than offensive ones. So then both sides got stuck in the trenches. And the casualty rates also horrified everybody, that literally every day hundreds of people, sometimes thousands, were being killed. So already by Christmas of 1914, when the war had been going on for 4 months, there was a terrible feeling of exhaustion and disillusionment. And the soldiers more or less spontaneously said, we're going to take a day off from this. They certainly weren't authorized to do it.
Well, one of those soldiers was Captain Charles Stockwell, one of the first soldiers to take part in the truce. And we have, actually, this is a dramatic reading of one of his letters about this day. This comes from the History Channel.
I ran out into the trench and found that the Saxons were shouting, "Don't shoot. We don't want to fight today. We will send you some beer." A German officer appeared and walked out into the middle of no man's land. So, I moved out to meet him amidst the cheers of both sides. We met and formally saluted. He introduced himself as Count something or other and seemed a very decent fellow.
Very decent. That's British, isn't it? But first of all, let's talk about what no man's land is. What is that?
because the weapons were so dangerous, the men very rapidly realized they had to dig trenches into the ground simply to stay out of sight of one another, to stay alive. And so all the way across northern Europe, from the North Sea coast to the Swiss border, lines of trenches developed. And very often the English soldiers would only be a couple of hundred yards from the German soldiers, each group in their own trenches, and each with the knowledge that if they appeared above the parapet of the trench, they'd be shot. And throughout the war, that's what happened. But they were close enough that they could hear each other's conversations. And as we just heard in that extract, very often the Christmas truce began with the singing of carols, and each side could hear the other. The German High Command had also had the idea of sending Christmas trees to their men. Christmas trees were originally a German tradition. And sometimes the Germans would decorate the trees and put them up on the parapet so the English soldiers could see them. And when the singing started, and then especially when people on both sides started holding up white flags or holding up signs that said, "Don't shoot and we won't shoot," the slightly braver ones took the risk of climbing up and exposing themselves, which normally would be lethal, to begin to fraternize. I think also at first some of the truces were a very practical matter, that when men were shot during raids and attacks, sometimes their bodies would continue to lie there. And one of the things that happened during the truce was simply coming out to both sides agreeing to bury the bodies of the men from their own sides. But then it also led to fraternization, like the exchanging of tobacco, the exchanging of alcohol, like this officer mentioned, and then also to playing soccer matches.
So why was there no Christmas truce of 1915?
Because when the senior officers heard about what had happened in 1914, they were absolutely furious about it. Their view was, I mean, on the British side, for example, there was, we're fighting a war for freedom. Why on earth would you interrupt the quest for freedom to fraternize with the very people whose job it's your job to kill? They're the enemies of civilization. They're not people we should fraternize with. And so some of the people who'd participated in the truce were punished. Some were circulated out to different parts of the Western Front. And when Christmas 1915 came along and the war was still going on, very strict orders went out that nobody was to expose themselves to the enemy, and that if they saw any sign of concessions from the enemy, they were to shoot them down instantly. And so from then on, there was no subsequent Christmas truce.
The opera Silent Night is a creative retelling of the story of the Christmas truce, when French, German, and British soldiers laid down their arms during World War I. It was the run-up to Christmas of 1914. We just told you the history of that event. Now let's hear what it sounds like when it's set to music. Kevin Putz is the composer of Silent Night, and baritone Troy Cook stars in the production as Father Palmer. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kevin, the opera is called Silent Night. Does that mean you needed a version of that Christmas carol in it somewhere?
Well, to the displeasure of some, there is no instance of that Christmas carol. We just thought it was a good title for a piece where, you know, it was silent, no bombs and no shooting. But all the music in the opera is original, including several Christmas carols that we had fun writing on our own.
So why this subject, Kevin? What drew you to this particular story?
Well, it was actually the idea of Dale Johnson, who is the artistic director of the Minnesota Opera. He contacted me kind of out of the blue. He had heard some of my orchestral music and had in his mind that he wanted to make the French film of 2005 called Joyeux Noël on this subject into an opera. And he thought that my music sounded like a step in the right direction. So we talked, and I saw the film, and with what little experience at the time I had with opera, I could imagine a lot of it on the stage, and I thought it would be very beautiful sung. And then I met Mark Campbell, the librettist, and we shared ideas about it and just went from there.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. This is the sleep chorus from this opera, Silent Night. This is a moment when soldiers from all of the armies are on stage together. They're settling in for the night. They speak in their respective languages, German, French, and English. And this is a performance from the Cincinnati Opera. So it can be, Troy, difficult sometimes and scary when it's a new opera, right?
Sure. And also exciting, I have to say.
Why do you say that?
Well, I remember going through the workshop process of doing this opera, and there was just this feeling in the room, this palpable feeling that something really special was being created. And I guess when you think about doing a new opera, if you're a presenter and you're doing it something completely unknown and you have to sell it to an audience, that is the scary part.
Right.
But that's one thing that I'm here to tell you. There's nothing in Silent Night to be afraid of, because it won the Pulitzer Prize for a reason.
In 2012, yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if, say, Don Giovanni's about is a cautionary tale, and, you know, many of the other operas are basically about revenge, what is the deeper theme behind this one, do you think?
I think this has to do with humanity, the commonality of simply being a human being. You can be, like in the trenches of World War I, in a horrible, horrible situation, but these gentlemen in this story, they were able to see through all of that into each other's commonality, what is common between them, and into their humanity as well.
And what do you feel about that, Kevin, in terms of the deeper themes behind this opera? What do you feel is actually happening on stage? Where have you taken the audience by the time the opera ends?
Well, I think that when Mark Campbell and I write any opera, we're almost finished with three now. We always need to have some idea of what it's about, and we kind of hold that as our mantra. And I think with Silent Night, the idea was once you know your enemy, they sort of no longer become your enemy. And I think that kind of naivety and ignorance of the other side, of other cultures, is at the heart of so many problems that we have, not only politically and, you know, as in terms of country, but even like different types of people and, you know, religions and sexual orientations and all kinds of things. So just because there's such distance, there's no contact. Once there is contact, it's difficult to maintain that relationship of being enemies, I think.
So let's hear a little bit more of it. This is from Opera Philadelphia, their production of Silent Night. You have sung in several different productions of this.
Yes, this is my second production, and for a piece that's been written so recently,
yeah,
for it to already have two productions.
Right, and that's my question. Yeah. Why do you think this has such resonance?
I think it truly goes back to the humanity thing. I think people can see themselves on the stage. And I think, you know, with things, with timeless stories like La Boheme, people are able to see themselves and their friends on the stage and relate in a very immediate way. And I feel that's true with this piece. Like, the horrors of World War I are immense, and to try to take all of that horror in is overwhelming to a person. But if you whittle it down to three storylines, basically, of three different troop members, it allows you into that life in a way that won't overwhelm you, that you can actually understand what it was like.
That is Troy Cook. He sings the role of Father Palmer in the opera Silent Night. It's the story of the Christmas truce on stage, maybe truth as well, at the Atlanta Opera, November 5th, 8th, 11th, and 13th. You can find showtimes at atlantaopera.org. Kevin Putz composed the music. Thank you both so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation to maybe broaden it out. John Horgan is a science journalist who teaches at Stevens Institute of Technology, and he's the author of the book called The End of War. Hi, John.
Hi.
And I want to go back to this question about the resonance of this particular opera. And Troy was talking about people being able to see themselves on stage. And I wonder if it feels at this point as though, even though Americans, for example, are not hopefully taking up arms with one another, maybe it feels as though we're at a war of some kind politically.
Yeah, I just have to say, I've always loved this story of the Christmas truce. It almost sounds like a fantasy, but it's true. And I think the possibility that's raised in my mind by this event is of all soldiers laying down their arms. I mean, why can't we have a world in which we all recognize our common humanity and give up this terrible, irrational form of resolving our conflicts? This has been an age-old hope. It is dismissed by the vast majority of people today as a pipe dream, as impossibly utopian. It's a kind of paradise that we will never achieve. So I wrote The End of War to try to convince people that the abolition of war, world peace, is actually possible. And that what you had with the Christmas truce, we could have that on a global scale. That's my hope, and I actually think that that could happen quite rapidly.
You still think that, and I want to test that out, because I'm reading this news story this morning about militia groups here in Georgia who already mobilizing for rifle practice and hand-to-hand combat and training for November 8th should Hillary Clinton win.
It's a scary period right now, and of course there's the terrible conflict in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. Yeah. War still exists around the world. But what people should know is that there has been a massive decline of all kinds of violence over the past few centuries around the world. And war, in particular, has really declined since the end of World War II. War between global powers has pretty much disappeared. There are very serious civil wars around the world. But my hope is that if we have the will and if we can overcome our fatalism and despair about ending war, that we can end it quite rapidly. I think that this should be the goal of all intellectuals, all of the people in our national security establishment. I'm hopeful that the United States, which right now is a very warlike, violent nation, can be a leader in taking the entire world toward a permanent peace.
We got a message from one of our listeners. Scotty Simmons writes this. During the manipulations for the war in Iraq, I had a worldwide wish and visual fantasy that came to me in epic color and action. I saw all major nations landing their armies and equipment in Iraq under orders from the United Nations Assembly to stop that war. This type of action would be used in all countries from that point forward. Now, that's a vision Scotty had. If any of you out there have visions or thoughts about this, you can post them to our Facebook page or tweet us at OST Talk. I'm speaking with John Horgan, whose latest book is The End of War. So, John, you say that there's actually been a decline in violence. Why then do we feel as though there's been an increase?
Well, here in the United States, we actually have very high rates of homicide compared to, for example, Western Europe, and we have been embroiled in these wars ever since 9/11. I teach at a university in New Jersey, and I have students who have never known their country not to be at war. And so we're immersed in these stories and images of war, so it's natural that we think of the world as profoundly violent. And it is still a scary, dangerous place, but there are very positive global trends, and we just have to build on those. And by the way, responding to what your listener said, I don't think the solution to ending war is a gigantic war. That's what some people thought about World War One, and that didn't exactly work out.
And okay, so here's the thing, though, John. As far as I know, and I'm no historian, or certainly not an ancient historian, we don't really have in recorded history a period of time when the entire world was at peace.
Yeah, there have almost always been hot spots here and there, but there have been periods of relative peace. For example, after the Napoleonic Wars in the early 19th century, Europe was just totally exhausted. And there was a period of relative peace that, of course, was demolished when World War One broke out. After World War One, there was such horror at all the carnage that there was a really powerful peace movement in the United States and in Europe, and in World War II, the Nazis ended that. I'm hopeful, and you know, this is my hope is inspired in part by stories like the Christmas Truce. I'm hopeful that we can have a coalition of traditional anti-war activists and leftists, joined by religious people whose own scriptures preach peace, and even fiscal conservatives who should be appalled at the immense waste of our defense spending, that we can have this broad coalition of people who just demand that our country start seeking nonviolent means of resolving its conflicts, and that we can start moving away from this period of militarism quite rapidly. I really think that's possible if we have tough, imaginative, courageous leadership.
And yet the reason we're talking about this is because of this opera at the Atlanta Opera, Silent Night, which is the story of the Christmas Truce, and it'll be on stage for four nights now in November. And based on the story of that opera, which is a true story, and what you just talked about, John, it almost sounds as like the only periods of relative peace that we've had in the world have been after horrifying war and loss of life.
Well, so here's when people are really pessimistic about war. So my students, the vast majority of them, almost every student in every class that I've taught, has thought that war is a permanent part of the human condition, and they say that humans are inherently selfish and greedy, and you know, as long as somebody disagrees with somebody else's ideology, we're going to have war or want something that somebody else has. And I often teach in a classroom right across the Hudson River from New York City, and I say, look over there at New York. There are people with every possible ideology, poor people, rich people, Republicans, Democrats, and yet New York City, believe it or not, is remarkably peaceful. Even rates of homicide have declined drastically since the late 80s and early 90s. You also have large portions of the world, for example, South America, which were once quite warlike and are now peaceful. Recently, because of the peace declared in Colombia, the entire Western Hemisphere is war-free. So I like to point to these examples of localized regions of peace to give people hope that we can achieve this on a global scale.
So we have about a minute left, a little less, John. What is our first step? Is it to stop arguing on Facebook?
That might help, although, you know, humans, we're a fractious species. I think we're gonna continue arguing. I would never expect that kind of conflict to cease. What I hope is that people realize that ending war is not a fantasy. It's not a hippie pipe dream. It is an achievable goal, and it's a moral imperative as much as ending slavery was. If we have the will to do it, and if we demand that our leaders seek it, we can achieve it.
That is John Horgan. His latest book is The End of War. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Celeste.